Hi, this is Tamson Granger.
This is Dan Apua.
With Tamson and Dan, read the paper on Monday, March 11th, 2024. Dan's already shaking his head at me.
Well, whatever. You know, I'm fighting a cold, Tamson. Fighting a cold. Okay. Not everybody can do this, fighting a cold.
Right? Oh, really? Okay.
I'm pulling myself together.
I can do it by myself.
No, you can't. All right. So, yes, let's get going. Do you have any opening remarks to make?
Well, I want to say happy birthday to Mark.
Oh, yeah. Happy birthday, Mark.
Because his birthday is coming up in a couple of days.
All right.
So we were celebrating like mad this past weekend.
Yeah. Still getting up. Maybe that's why I'm sick.
Oh, really? Too much celebrating?
Yeah, too much celebrating. I'm not built for that.
So we'll talk about how we celebrated it in a minute. But, you know, it's been, I think winter's coming to an end.
Sure, why not? It's March.
Mean, we've been hunkered down, doing indoor activities, trying to play ping pong.
And?
Table tennis.
Right.
So you know what I did today?
No.
You know what I was contemplating?
No.
We have a lot of ping pong paddles. They all are completely shot. They're dried out. They're cracked.
They're fine.
The covers on them.
They're fine.
So I thought I'll replace the rubber part.
Really?
And I looked it up.
Wow.
So the first...
You are looking for things to do. That's
no, all. I like to reclaim things. I like to renovate,
home
conservate.
Repair. There's no question.
Okay.
You'd be happy in a hardware store for hours.
You have no idea how much that rubber stuff costs.
I'm hoping the answer is 99 cents.
No, it costs zillions.
And don't do
it. And you can't buy like big rolls of it. No. You buy the square.
Yeah.
It's like 6 inches by 6 inches.
Yeah.
Okay? And the ones you come up with right away are like $40 a piece.
We're not doing that.
$70 a piece. Right. And there's a fancy glue you need to put on.
And yet,
you get some very cheap ones.
Yeah.
For like $14.
You can buy the whole paddle for $3, all right?
Yeah. You can buy four paddles and some balls.
Right.
For like $30.
Right.
But now we've got to do something with these 92 beat up paddles that are sitting around. But
the key is to have the ball hit the paddle. Once you get that down, we'll worry about the kind of paddle we got. But the key is hit the paddle.
I just thought it would be a clever thing to do. It's not clever at all.
Right?
You know? I had no idea.
Okay.
But, so the whole ping pong paddle thing is, it's a scam.
Yeah.
It's a scam.
Yeah.
When
you retread the tires on the car, that's a good project for you.
That would probably be cheaper.
Probably.
So, and we've been listening to vinyl.
Yeah. Records.
Trying to reclaim our vinyl collection.
Yeah.
See what's there. See how it sounds. So this past weekend, we listened to Laura Nyro.
Right.
I have two much beloved Laura Nyro albums, but I don't remember how I ever started listening to Laura Nyro.
That's not the headline.
What?
The headline is the albums were released in the late 60s. Maybe you bought them then. Maybe you bought them a year or two later. And
I did not buy.
Okay. And
Laura Nyro albums when I was 12 years old.
Can I get to
the headline? Much later, in college.
You weren't, honey.
I was late to the party.
It was a long time ago. It was 50 years ago.
Still a long time ago.
And how did the record sound on the new system?
Shockingly good.
Unbelievable.
And I had played these records.
Unbelievable.
In the way that you play them over and over again.
Stunning.
Okay.
It was stunning.
All right. So we mentioned Laura Nyro to Mark and Javier.
Well, they never heard of her.
Never heard of her.
Right.
Well, it's not like they're 20.
But this surprised me.
But we were looking up things like when these records were released.
Right.
Okay, when these albums were released.
Yeah.
And we end up on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And we end up on the section saying legacy.
Yeah.
And everybody seems to, revere Laura Nyro.
Yeah. So Laura Nyro, what was she, from the Bronx or something like that? She was someplace in the
city. I don't
even
remember.
Yeah, she has an inner city background. And she wasn't a huge commercial success. Singer-songwriter, sort of, at the beginning of the singer-songwriter thing. But someone who didn't scream commercial. And yet wrote a lot of songs that were covered by a lot of bands that were commercial. But even more to the point, as you say, turned out to be an enormous influence and a lot of very commercial, very successful artists. So it went on for pages and pages and pages. And also, she interacted with them. I mean, Jackson Brown was her opening act. She also had an affair with Jackson Brown. We won't pause on that. And ultimately, she was an opening act for Bob Dylan. I mean, she knew everybody.
She had a recording business.
Yeah, she had a recording business with David Geffen.
Which they sold for almost $5 million.
She looked like...
She was in her 20s.
You know, she's completely bohemian. You figure that she's wearing, old Earth shoes or something like that. She's a millionaire. I mean, sadly, she passed at the age of 49 from cancer. But she, again, very bohemian and not known everybody. Sort of like, what's Janis Ian, that type of figure, right? Not really.
And she
even covered other people's songs. She covered Carole King's songs. Carole King.
Up on the Roof.
Yeah.
Up on the Roof.
Carole King covered her songs.
And you pointed out to me, it says that Paul Schaefer, David Letterman band leader, which chose as his...
It's called the Desert Island Disc. His Desert Island Disc was Laura Nero's album called Eli's Coming.
No, Eli...
In the 13th Confession. Okay, but the song is Eli's Coming, for those who know the song. Recorded, good example of a cover, by Three Dog Night. She wrote that song. But Paul Schaefer wanted her version. So,
I haven't listened to Laura Nero in a long time, and it was just... a joy.
Yep.
It was great.
We have other records like that.
And then you were killing me in Dutch Blitz. We've been playing this card game.
This is all too obscure.
Called Dutch Blitz.
Yes. We'll get into Dutch Blitz.
I don't know.
Google
it.
We can't.
It's kind of a fun game. I'm not a card player, so it's funny. Some weeks I'm good at it and some weeks you're good at it.
Well, I'm always good at it, but sometimes you win. That's
nice.
Yeah. All right, nice. So, but anyway, the more to the point, what people want to hear about is what we're doing. What we're doing.
Well, we've also been reading.
All right, you want to talk about that? You can, but then
you reading? Because every day you say some new revelation about how much you love this book.
No one's going to want to read this. I mean,
Just pass it on.
Look, I'm reading a novel by Ian McEwan. Is Ian McEwan the greatest living writer alive? Possibly. I mean, depends on your taste, right? But, he's got an uber successful career, highly respected. He's more in the nature of a John Updike, Philip Roth, but a little more modern. He's English, so he's not an American. He wrote Atonement, he wrote Saturday, he wrote a whole bunch of novels. I'm reading Lessons, happens to be the name of it. It was published in 2022. But the subject matter doesn't matter. What's interesting to me is that, I don't come back to him that often. Because it's not like any of the subject matter of any of his books cries out to me. But once you start reading his stuff, even if the subject matter is obscure, even if the characters go in, strange directions, he's such a fantastic writer, you just kind of shake your head. I mean, you can't put it down. It's not worth my describing anything that's going on in the book. It wouldn't be compelling.
Okay.
But...
Lessons. Lessons by Ian McEwan.
Yeah, I mean...
I think I turned you on to Ian McEwan.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yeah, 100%.
Why do you think that's true?
Because I remember I was reading something by him.
Yeah.
I don't remember if it was...
Well, Atonement would have been the most likely thing.
Might have been Atonement. And I said, Dan would really like this.
Really?
And we never, our reading
we don't read
taste
the same thing.
Doesn't cross over much at all.
Yeah.
So...
I'm looking up his books now. I'm just to see what book you might have read.
No, let's not go into it.
All right. So what are you reading?
I won't remember.
What are you reading?
I'm not going to reveal what I'm reading because it's boring as hell.
What are you listening to?
No, what I'm listening to.
It's similar.
What I've been listening to lately are books by Abraham Verghese. And
I'm shaking my head.
Yeah. They're great. First of all, numero uno. They're a delight to listen to. They're both terrific recordings.
Yeah.
And it's like being in a play. You're kind of immersed. And, some books are better read than others.
Yeah.
And these are both well done. Cutting for Stone and Covenant of Water. They take place in exotic locales with a variety in the cast of characters. You know, mostly Asian Indian. They take place in India. The locations are in India, Ethiopia, the Bronx. If anybody's looking for something good to listen to, that will take them a long way. Both of these books are over 20 hours. I really highly recommend. I'm not going to say what they're about because I was not interested in the subject matter yet. Both very compelling and entertaining and engaging. Abraham Verghese.
Okay.
But moving right along.
Yes.
We've been to the theater.
Yeah. All right. We've been to the theater a lot, right? I don't know why we're holding this back. We went to two plays this week. That's unprecedented. Two plays. And the trick is they were both local. Otherwise, you couldn't possibly do it. You couldn't go to New York and come back and go to New York. And there's a kind of story behind both. So the first thing we did was on a whim. We went to see a production of A Little Night Music, the Stephen Sondheim musical. And talk about a local production. We just saw an ad for it, like online, at a theater that we never heard of in Basking Ridge, which is 50 minutes from us. And we noticed it starred Kate Baldwin. So it's a legitimate production. I mean, she's a Broadway actress. We've seen her in several things.
And we love Little Night
Music. And, you know, it's hard to miss with Little Night Music. So we said, what the heck? You know, it's reasonably priced. So we drove over there.
Well, actually, the thing is, there weren't many tickets, but as it turned out, you know, we thought we were doing something on Friday night. We weren't doing anything. So I went on the phone and, you know, got the tickets online. And they weren't very expensive. And they were, you know, at this theater.
All right. So I covered that.
Tempest. In New Jersey.
Here's the thing.
It's a last minute sperm of the moment idea.
All this covered.
Yeah.
All right. Keep up. So then we drive up and we're in something called Fellowship Senior Living. That's where we find ourselves.
Well, we're just senior living. Well, the ticket said Szymanski Theater.
Right.
Okay. And then Google, you know, we have the last turn from Google.
Yeah.
And it's into Fellowship Village.
Yeah.
And it turns out this is a good sized theater.
In a retirement village. So we're going, oh my God, how can this possibly work out?
The parking was easy because most of the crowd walked.
Exactly. Or, you know, rolled, whatever it's like. And it was a very nice theater, and it wasn't even the smallest theater in the world. I would say it had over 300 seats, the way they had it set up. And the bottom line is, I'll ask you first, what did you think of the production of the play?
I thought it was good. I mean, there were some technical glitches at the beginning.
Right.
Okay. But again, this is put on by a production group, American Theater Group.
Yeah.
And their two main locales are this theater and a theater in Rahway. This was, I guess, the second performance.
Yeah, they don't do much.
The second performance of this play. Of this production.
Yeah.
So, you know, they were ironing things out. There was that.
Yeah, there was a technical glitch. But
in general, it was quite good.
Yes, it was very good. It was excellent, you might even say. And I mean, it was one of those weird situations where the second act was better than the first. Not necessarily because the second act is better than the first in the Sondheim musical, but because they seemed to find their stride.
Right.
Somewhere late in the first act.
The actors seemed to be more comfortable.
They got more relaxed. The technical glitches were ironed out. And they were sailing in the second act. And it was very, very good. I was very glad that we went. And it was very professional production. As I said, Kate Baldwin, a fellow named Graham Rowat, played the other lead. But, you know, there are four or five, you know, serious parts in this. It has to be sung extremely well. It's kind of a challenging score. And everyone was very professional. It was very well done. Interestingly, they had live music. You don't always see live music in these smaller productions, but they had broken it down to three pieces. So they had three pieces in the rear of the stage, a piano, a cello, and a harp, of all things. So that made it kind of interesting.
They said in the program online, it said they adapted the production slightly. Yes. It's usually 15 piece.
Well, yeah, it was 15 players, actually, I think, is what they said. Oh, it was 15 players, and they brought it down to 10. Well, they scaled it down.
They scaled down the number of
players
and the number of musicians to make it doable, I guess, at this level.
Yeah. So, anyway, we were very pleased with it. We enjoyed ourselves quite a bit. We happened to be sitting a few rows behind the director who we recognized, who was Hunter Foster, who we had seen a million years ago in Urinetown.
On Broadway.
Yeah, some 20 years ago. And it doesn't make any sense that we both recognize them. It's not like he's that recognizable, although he does look a little bit like his sister, Seton Foster. So there's that. But even so,
it does make sense. He was the one younger guy walking around. I mean, let's face it. We were on the younger side of the crowd, which never happens.
Well, he's
and then he was... You know, this guy came in, a guy walked in looking pretty smooth with a bevy of young assistants around him. And so I was assuming that was Hutton Foster.
I recognized him. But in any event, and as a matter of fact, he directs things at the Bucks County Playhouse. So he's kind of a figure in this area in small theaters.
Well, it gave you a feeling for these people, you know, kind of sprinting around. Doing all these different productions, whether it's Kate Baldwin.
Yeah, they're hustling.
Because we had just seen her a few months ago in Bridges of Madison County at Bucks County.
And we had seen her a year or two ago at a Low Dolly in New York. So
did Hunter Foster direct that?
He directed the Bridges of Madison County.
So all these people are like zipping about.
Right. It's not
cobbling together a living.
It's life on the wicked stage. It's hard to make a living. But, you know, on the other hand, he's doing a lot of interesting things. So, anyway, so that was good. So then we follow that up in terms of a double-decker. The next night, we went to Music Mountain Theater, which we've mentioned before, which is a very local amateur theater right nearby in Lambertville. And they had a production of Fun Home. And Fun Home is a musical that we had never
seen. Why do you call them amateur?
Because we're going to discuss this again. I'm telling you, the performers are not paid.
All right. But first of all, you don't know that. And does it really matter?
Yes, it does
matter. We paid for the tickets.
No. It matters because you can't license the material on the basis of
That's what a lawyer would say. I think you say it just
Let me tell you why I say it.
Dismissive.
No. It's the opposite. Because when I walk in there and it's an amateur production, I lower my expectations. And I'm therefore mightily impressed.
So patronizing.
No, it's not.
No. Just don't say it anymore. Okay. I don't want to hear that word.
It's a regional
amateur
production.
Just means lover. Okay.
Lover.
These are lovers of theater.
Okay. Amateur.
That's
where you don't get paid.
No.
In case you're wondering, go to the dictionary.
Leave it. No.
Look it up.
Amateur comes from.
Uh oh. What?
The French word lover to be a lover of.
Is that right?
Yes.
Are you making this up?
Amor amat amat means to love in Latin.
Oh,
okay,
I can't believe you're pulling the Latin.
All right.
My point is that it was a production that didn't have the kind of prestige people that the previous production had at this theater in Lambertville. It had canned music, which means it was tape music. They didn't have any live music there. And it's a very ambitious program in which they put on two musicals a month would be roughly average. It's almost amazing they do that. Again, Fun Home we hadn't seen. What do you think of Fun Home?
It was excellent.
It was absolutely excellent.
There were many younger performers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have no complaints with any of them.
Right.
You know, they were great. The adults were great. It went... it was flawless, the performance.
Yeah. So just to explain. So Fun Home is based on a play by Alison Bechdel, who's a cartoonist. And it's really about her growing up and her experience, coming out as lesbian to her family and her father's sexual orientation.
And he committed suicide. So it's a memoir of her growing up and coming of age story.
Right. And it was on off Broadway in the early 2000s. It made it to Broadway in 2015. And it won the Tony Award for Best Musical.
Did you know any of the music? Because they played songs a lot on...
I'm sorry. There are one or two songs I recognize from. Okay, yeah. You know, like the...
Broadway Channel on Sirius.
Yes, the Keys song, I knew that. Because they play that. You know, when the woman walks in the room.
See How We Shine and Polish?
No, that's a different song. I can look up the name of the song.
I don't know what you're calling
possibly.
The Keys song.
Yeah, well, the girl says she got excited when she saw this person walk in the room dressed a particular way.
Oh, the keys, literally keys.
Ring of Keys.
Yeah, that's a great song. Yeah.
So, but here's the interesting thing about the music, okay?
But and I was thinking, I'm going to major in Joan is pretty.
It's clever, but yeah. The Keys song.
That's known.
Right? Oh, is it well known?
Joan
song.
So, yeah.
Well known? I don't think I heard that.
Okay.
But in any event, so it's written by Jeanine Tesori. Now, Jeanine Tesori happens to have been the person who wrote a lot of musicals that we've seen. And I'm going to list them to save us time. So it's Kimberly Akimbo. Now it's Fun Home. Caroline or Change. Violet, she wrote. And she also happened to write Thoroughly Modern Millie and Shrek. And she's written a bunch of shows.
Right. We talked about her a year or two ago.
And it's interesting is the music lends itself very much to the action on stage. But I will say, you know, the next day it's very hard to bring up a melody. It's not the kind of thing like some enchanted evening. You know, it's not it's a different kind of songwriting. She's obviously very successful. I happen to find a quote from Anthony Tomasini, who you'll recall we happened to see in conversation with Sondheim a few years ago at the New York Times building, in which he's talking about this show. And he says, quote, Tesori's score is a masterpiece. And listen to this quote. These are, quote, Sondheim-influenced songs that unfold over insistent rhythmic figures and shifting rich harmonies. So he's comparing her to Sondheim. Now, I would have said she's nothing like Sondheim, which is not an insult to her. It strikes me as very different, but he's much more sophisticated musically than I am. But the point is, her music's good. I mean, every time we see a show of hers, the music's compelling. And I thought this music was very compelling.
Yeah. No, it was great. And now that you're saying that, it makes me, I would love to see Caroline or Change again.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you want to see Shrek. That's not the answer.
Well, Shrek was funny enough, but Caroline or Change was powerful.
I preferred this to Caroline or Change, honestly. But, you know, whatever. It doesn't make any difference. They're both worth seeing. And I actually prefer Violet to both of them.
Okay.
But my point really is they're all good. And Kimberly Akimbo, I mean, probably preferred both of them too. I mean, they're all very good shows.
Yeah. So we didn't...
But again, the bottom line is Music Mountain. It's, you know, stone's
throw from
there.
The bottom line is, wherever you are, you know, give the small theaters a chance.
Yeah.
You know, it's worth it, and it's not $568.
Well, it's not the money. It's the convenience, really.
It's the money, too. Yeah. You know, you can't run out every day and go to Broadway. That's impossible now. Yeah. You got to pay $200 for a skimpy dinner and $200 a ticket minimum.
Yeah.
Minimum.
Yeah.
But, we didn't talk... We take it for granted that everybody knows all the Sondheim. Little Night Music is the one with Send in the Clowns.
Yeah.
Which could be the most cliched song you can think of.
Right.
You know, for our age group. I mean, that was an extremely oft-recorded song.
Too oft-recorded.
That you don't even want to hear it. Right. Say, oh, no. And yet it is a beautifully poignant song. And in the right hands... It's great, and it was in the right hands.
Yeah. As long as you
saw it this
weekend. It's based on a Bergman, Ingmar Bergman film, "Songs of a Summer Night," I think. It's top Sondheim. It's in the top five Sondheim shows, which is saying something.
Yeah.
We enjoy it a great deal.
So we had theater wise. Yeah. We had a good weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, God, you had something about The Color Purple, right?
Not the book, right. not the play, right. not the movie, but
yes.
the color.
Yeah.
And no, in the Science Times, you know, I love the Science Times, and especially when they have something a little bit archaeological. And there was a little bit about production of purple. And it mentions, I love this beginning sentence, the most prized pigment of antiquity was processed not from a tangle of root or the frothy extract of a weed, but by drawing out a slimy secretion from the mucous glands behind the anus of a Murex sea snail, the bottom of the bottom feeders. Okay, that's where purple comes from.
That's as gross as it could possibly be.
It is, okay. The common name of the dye stuff, Tyrian purple, derives from the habitat of the mollusks, easy yeah. for me to say, which the Phoenicians purportedly began harvesting in the 16th century BC. In the city-state of Tyre in present-day Lebanon. Okay, 16th century. But, purple was extremely labor-intensive, as you can imagine, because each snail yielded little more than a drop. Some 250,000 were required for an ounce of dye.
First of all, this is gross. Secondly, it's kind of not believable. So, whatever.
No, I mean, that's why it was extremely valuable. Extremely, extremely valuable. You know, worth three times its weight in gold.
Uh-huh.
And the Romans had laws about who could wear it. The emperor. Yeah. Only the emperor could wear it. He was in full control of wearing purple cloth. Senators could wear a purple stripe on their toga,
mm-hmm.
but only the emperor could have full purple. Anyway, so it was incredibly valuable. And it turns out what they thought was some kind of fort or something on Israel's Carmel coast at Tel Shikmona, all right, just a little bit south of Tyre, between 1150 BC and 600 BC, was actually probably a purple production location. And they were cranking out this stuff.
Okay.
And so they've been sort of, archaeologists have been looking at this site for years and years and years, and you know, and noting what was going on and what was there, and like I said, they thought it was a fort or something.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out it was a big purple production plant. So you know, that for some reason somebody, you know, finally began to realize that, and you know, it just began to really pop out at them. To them, why there was a little purple here, a little purple there, you know, these kinds of shards of this there, and put it all together, and it was really a good production. So I think that's kind of fun. It was the only color fast dye in antiquity,
mm-hmm.
you know, known to the ancients. So it was something that actually, with wear, you know, as it aged, got brighter. Mm-hmm. And so again, you know, incredibly difficult to come up with, incredibly valuable. And we, you know, learning more about the story of purple. Purple actually is Pepper's favorite color.
For a good reason.
Purple is also my sister Sarah's favorite color. Right, so these women have expensive taste.
So you all had something on stained glass too?
Me again?
Yes.
Just a quick thing. A little article online about Woodlawn Cemetery.
Yeah.
You know, I love cemeteries. Mm-hmm. And I love stained glass. I did my senior thesis at Princeton on stained glass. And so there's a new project going on, actually, to some extent, headed up by my fellow Princeton alum, classmate, Nani Kuni Frelinghuysen.
Right.
Actually, she uses the name Alice now. They're doing a study of stained glass in mausoleums in Woodlawn Cemetery. So the mausoleums are the little buildings, right? And so they're usually locked, so people don't go in them. Well, it turns out many of these buildings from a certain period have spectacular stained glass windows by people like Tiffany or John Lafarge. So there's a project going on where they have actually, you know, made keys to get in these locked places and make a study of the different windows. And conserve. Some of them are broken and need repair, etc. And so, I mean, they're able to now find catalog windows that nobody knew about from these terrific artists from the period.
Huh.
Woodlawn Cemetery. It'll be fun if we can get to see them at some point.
Huh. Good.
You know, the cemeteries are a wonderful font of art, okay, between sculpture, sculptural styles, et cetera. And usually they're free to get into.
Oh, you're selling on them. Okay.
We've had some wonderful afternoons wandering around cemeteries, and you know it. It's, you know, it's a beautiful place to walk. They were the first public parks. They're the first sort of open sculpture parks as well. All right, go ahead. Talk about something like sports.
Sports. Well, there was an article. I don't know if this is sports. There was, as the Times says, drive to unionize began in dining hall. You've been seeing articles where the Dartmouth basketball team has now made an application to form a union.
Well, we're going to talk.
What?
About wages in restaurants.
Yeah, we will, but we're not talking about it yet.
And the end of that article, they say unions unionizing labor is in.
Yeah,
you know,
it's in.
You know, not since the 20s and 30s have unions been such a thing.
First of all,
go ahead.
Point one, that's wrong. But secondly, let me go back to basketball. This is dumb beyond belief. Let me stick with basketball.
Starbucks.
No.
Everybody is.
No.
It's trying to unionize lately.
That's another subject. Let's start with this. Okay. All right? Okay. This doesn't make any sense. Now, it may make sense at a certain point for athletes and colleges to unionize, in particular, big-time college football. You know, the University of Alabama football team could unionize.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be meaningful because, arguably, they bring more value to the institution than they're granted by virtue of their scholarship. So there's something there. There's no there with the Dartmouth basketball team. The Dartmouth basketball team is playing Ivy League basketball. They're not attracting a lot of attention. They lose three times as many games as they win. No one cares about Dartmouth basketball. If the Dartmouth basketball players who are unionizing were to all quit basketball tomorrow when they brought up an intramural team, it wouldn't affect Dartmouth in the least. It's just too bad that something that could be a serious issue kind of came up this way. But it just shows how wacky things. It's not wacky. I don't want to. There are kids. It's a college project. They said, "Hey, maybe we can unionize. It's fun." But economically, it doesn't go anywhere.
I disagree.
Because
I'm sure the whole thing was thought up by a marketing major.
Yeah. Okay.
Who said, "When was the last time Dartmouth basketball has been on?" Any news?
That could be.
Okay.
I'd go with that. I don't disagree with that.
It's a brilliant stroke.
It's a brilliant publicity thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So by coincidence, it's sort of related to the subject of college student athletes and where athletics are going at the college level. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal called College Scholarships for Cornhole. Cornhole being the game that we've seen, maybe even played a little bit, where there's a board. Usually set up outside a bar, which is on an angle, and you're tossing beanbags into the hole.
Well, it's in people's backyards and things.
Well,
you don't need a bar to play cornhole.
But that's part of the point. It could be anywhere.
Cornhole's a real
thing.
There's
nothing wrong with cornhole.
Okay.
And yet, it's not what I would call big-time sport. Having said that...
I think in some places it is,
Sadly,
Daniel.
No. It can't be. But the article was that there's a picture of these two kids wearing sweatshirts from Winthrop University, which is in South Carolina, because they have just been recruited from a high school in Colorado on the basis of their ability to play cornhole. They're going to be the stars of the Winthrop University competitive cornhole team, and they receive partial scholarships on that basis. Why, some might ask, is South Carolina reaching out to Colorado and making their mark here? There's a number of reasons. Number one is cornhole is now a, quote, professional sport, and its headquarters and its main competitions are located in South Carolina. So it's a cornhole region of the country. But also because Winthrop has figured out this is the direction to go with college sports. Winthrop, I think, is a very good basketball team, but they don't have a football team. And they quote the athletic director here, who informs the Wall Street Journal that they have made a major investment in video gaming esports. They have the top team in the country, he says, in that connection. They hope to be a power in cornhole. And he said, quote, it costs universities a lot of money to be a Division I program. We can be resetting what sports can be. Again, another economic take, right?
Mm-hmm.
On college sports, where it might be going, and how you really are solving an economic puzzle as much as anything else. And the final economic article, it's economic summary. There's a time, and this is sort of incomplete, but the Times is reporting today, and others have, that Temple University is being investigated, the basketball team, with the possibility that there's been some point fixing on the part of the Temple University team. And the investigation is based on movements in betting that took place in the final few minutes, if not an hour, before the game. Huge movements in betting, which people monitor, the legal enforcement people do, because it suggested, in fact, that there is some fixing going on. And usually fixing in the nature of point spreads. One team says, well, we won't, we'll win by a certain amount. We won't win by that amount, so we won't beat the point spread. Or even the total, what's called the over-under, we'll make sure that the point total will be brought in under the over-under. And we'll see where that goes. But it looks bad for the Temple University basketball team because these kind of betting movements have been found in three or four separate games in which Temple participated in. Now, that is another way for a university student to make money, which is to take money from a gambler to fix things. And that's not unprecedented in college basketball. There's been more of that in college basketball than almost any other sport, historically, not necessarily recently. You may recall the Boston College scandal of some years ago, in which the main fixer was his fellow Harold Hill, who was actually a main character in Goodfellas. Even though the movie wasn't about that fixing, he's a figure in that. But to me, what's of greater interest, there are other scandals, City College, whatever, going back. The one I think of is the one at LIU, Long Island University, in 1951, where Long Island University, believe it or not, was the top basketball team in the country. It doesn't seem possible to say that, but it's true. And what killed the program was that following the 1951 season, it was determined that several players had been fixing games. And they had to close down the program for a number of years. And they went from top of the college heap to nothing. And the coach, you'll be interested to know, of that team was Claire B.
Hmm.
And Claire B, of course, being famous for writing the Chip Hilton books.
Right.
He wrote 25 different Chip Hilton books, which, a heroic high school and college figure. They're kind of young person's books, but they're wonderful books.
But how does that work? You're saying it's a way for a kid to make money, but doesn't he have to get other team members to go right along
usually
with the
usually
have
idea? One or two team members going with him.
But and one or two people can control the outcome of the game?
They can influence. They can't control 100%, but they can have, depending if they're important players, they can certainly influence whether they beat a point spread or don't beat a point spread. When you're gambling, all you want is an edge. You don't demand 100%. But if your chances of winning aren't 51% but 70%, you'll take it. So it's worth spending some money. Now, you can't fix a pro game because those guys make too much money. But you can fix a college game because the college kids arguably need the money. Well, it's interesting about Chip Hilton. Claire B, without dwelling on this. So, of course, you know, Claire B, you know, didn't have a program anymore after 1951, but he had 20 books to write. And what happens to Chip Hilton as time goes on is that he becomes a figure who speaks out against any kind of compensation for sports.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that he refuses to go pro because he doesn't think anyone should be paid money for playing sports. And he refuses college scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
So Claire B. was making a point.
Mm-hmm.
So in any event, I found that sort of an odd connection. Well, I recommend the Chip Hilton books. What can I say? A world that's has gone by. All right, we're going to talk about restaurant and pay. You were saying that the Times says that unions are the thing. Yeah, that to me is a very general
statement.
That's
the way the article ends. Yeah, and what it's really talking about is, again, what we were talking about last week, which restaurant tipping. And in Washington, they have voted to...
They voted to raise the minimum wage.
Wage so to be equal...
Right.
So there's a...
it's called a no-tipping minimum wage.
Right.
So you can only pay that minimum wage if there's going to be no tipping, because otherwise it's completely out of whack. So rather than have a minimum wage, they used to have a minimum wage for people who were tipped.
There's the tipped wage.
Right, which is a lower figure.
And now they're bringing it up.
Right.
All right.
And, it's
and so the tipped wage was like...
it was probably $15.
No, it was...
$8?
$8.
Okay.
So it's up to $8 now. It was like five something.
Okay. What's the non-tipped wage?
The non-tipped minimum wage is $17.
Right. So if you're running a restaurant, and this is, when you say the unions have nothing to do with this. This is the law. This is the law.
Right. Okay? Right. Yeah.
So the bright guys in Washington, D.C. saying, we're going to pass a law, we're going to help everybody out, and we're going to raise this minimum wage to $17. Which means, as everyone understands it, that the only way the restaurants can operate now is to say to the diners, okay, we've raised prices so that we can pay this wage, but there'll be no tipping, right? It's really a non-tipped wage.
Yeah.
And the question is, how's that working out? And the bottom line is, you know, it's anecdotal. The bottom line generally is it's a little rough. It doesn't necessarily work out. One guy says at the end, I'm moving my restaurant, I hope one day, from Washington, D.C. to Virginia. It's because the notion of going non-tipping apparently it doesn't go as smoothly as you think. It doesn't go as smoothly as I would think. Because I was saying this to you before, why should that be so hard? Why can't you just say, okay, we're just moving some numbers around? Whereas before you paid X, now you're paying X for 20%. It's transparent.
It's so complicated.
Why?
I can't even imagine because, you know, all right, so the median hourly earnings for all restaurant workers in Washington, including tips, overtime, and other compensation, was $20.19 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. And it's come up from $18.93.
Right.
Okay, so, I mean...
Yeah, but I don't know what to do with those numbers because they include people who get tips and people don't get tips.
Right.
And I don't know what level of supervisors.
Well, this article is full of people with different experience.
Yeah.
There's a cocktail waitress who says her tips have gone down. Right?
They probably disappeared.
Her paycheck has gone down.
Yeah.
Okay. The bar has added a 20% service charge, which she feels discourages tipping.
Sure it does.
Well,
sure
it should.
It should.
Because it's service charge.
Let me tell you something. Discourages tipping. It should eliminate tipping.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
It should eliminate tipping.
All right. But she's saying, you know, her, even though she should be getting 20%, her paycheck has gone.
She's getting paid on a different basis.
Her take home has gone down.
No, she's just getting paid on a different basis. She doesn't have a real complaint except for this. When the people who are hurt by this, or the people who were generally able to get above average tips.
Yeah.
Extraordinary tips.
Right.
And the people who were helped by this were the people who either weren't getting tips or were getting below average tips. So this evens it out.
Because once again,
yeah,
you know, workers say they don't know necessarily what the owners are doing with the 20%.
Yeah, but they don't have to know.
Is it going directly to...
They don't have to know. That to me is irrelevant, okay? When you're a worker, you got one question. How much money am I going to make? Okay? You don't say to the guys running the restaurant, where is the money going? Or what are you paying for cornstarch? You're not getting into that.
Right.
What am I going
to get? But still, this person says they're getting less money.
Yes,
now, some of the other people in the article say they are making more money.
Sure.
There's other things that are competing. This is why I say it's complicated.
Yeah. Oh.
Because things are going on, like they're trying to increase contactless ordering.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So you don't need as many servers.
Okay.
All right. So the bar maid says she's actually getting less hours. Because of things like that.
But that's a different issue.
They're high. Yeah. So restaurateurs are trying to solve all kinds of problems.
Right.
And it's affecting.
Yeah. Look, I understand the restaurateurs are trying to solve a lot of problems. I will also say that one way not to solve your problems is to get the local government involved. That we know too. And that's what the Order of Kindness says. But it's all legitimate. I mean, I feel for the restaurateurs who are trying legitimately to, you know, take in as much revenue as possible and minimize their costs. I certainly feel for the workers who are trying to take in as much pay as they can. And what just makes things more complicated, but not necessarily better for anybody, is the local law.
Yeah.
Because somebody thought they were doing people a favor. But
They also cite one restaurant that has added a 20% fee.
Yeah.
But they still keep the tip line in.
Well, but they're not going to get tips. They're not going to get tips.
But most restaurants feel they cannot raise prices and have no fee.
Right.
Which would be another option that we've talked about before.
Right. Yeah, of course.
And they just say that, you know, that's impossible. People feel
if you raise your prices
are too high.
You have to be saying to them that we're displacing the tips. So part of the price here is
just
the tips.
But the other thing mentioned in the article, new restaurants are, there are even more new restaurants in Washington than the year before.
And you know what else? There'll be more new North American restaurants closing in Washington than in previous years.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So finally, just to wrap this up, there was an article about high school students. There was a program, high school students doing taxes. And I forget what part of the country that was from. It was just a relatively small program. And they were talking about the idea that they opened up a clinic and people would come by and the high school students would do people's taxes or answer their questions under the supervision of someone who kind of knew what they were doing. And that struck me as kind of a great idea because taxes, once you do a bunch of them, once you do, you have the familiarity with the program, you can add value because that's the way to become a sort of expert in that area.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not like they're, adding everything up themselves. They're using a program, Tax Slayer.
Right.
Okay. And they're, but, I mean, it has a lot of benefits. It benefits the community.
Yeah.
It's interaction between teenagers and all kinds of other age groups.
Right.
All right. It's, gives them actually potential for, a job.
But it also gives them exposure to people's economic lives. I mean, it gives them a preview of what it's like to be an adult.
Right. It's teaching a good life skill.
Yeah.
I mean, now they know how to do their taxes.
But again, just to see the way people
helping people.
And you see the way people make do and now where they're going to be 5-8 years from now. Now they might think about it.
And in this story, they talk about, well, this is in California, actually. And they talk about one guy came in who hadn't paid taxes in 7 years.
Yeah.
Right. And he had like 7 piles of materials. A woman came in who had 5 different jobs in the last year.
Yeah.
So they're learning a lot in a lot of different ways.
I can see. I would recommend this to high school to have this kind of tax clinic. I think that's good.
Yeah.
All right. So that's what we've
got. So you could do this. This is part of a program
by
the IRS called Volunteer Income Tax Assistance.
I could join up. I'll think about it.
Numbers limited people like myself, but
yeah, I could do it. So in any event, you could do it too. That's it. We've gone off quite a bit. So let's wrap it up. So,
this is Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuhoff.
Well, Tamsin and Dan read the paper, and, you know, God be willing, the creek don't rise. We will be back.
See you next week.